It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Hey, good morning, and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. We are sitting here in beautiful Hawaii and looking up there on the mountain, and there's a massive cloud bank embankment. It's quite impressive, beautiful. Every morning there's a different sight and a different reason to want to live and say I live here in Hawaii. Anyway, as I had mentioned last week, we were going to be talking about a visit that we made to the University of Hawaii. It was a seminar that was about public participation in a polarized era. So I said I'd play some audio, and we'll play that, and I'm hoping to have some callers later on. And join me, Bridget Hammerquist and others, regarding this. And let me make an adjustment here. So we... sounds a little better. I can hear myself talking. But the title was The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and it was about supposedly aimed at the public and to benefit the public. It was my interpretation. And the public, if you wanted to participate, you had to shell out $185 to attend. So anyway, there were some things there and raised some eyebrows. There were people like Ray Soon, who was on one of the panels and was a spokesperson there. And, you know, Ray Soon was with DHHL. He was also with the city managing director for Mayor Caldwell and a few other things. And we're talking about transparency and the public's right to know and the public rights to be informed. So what this meeting was, and I expressed my happiness with it, and that it's rare that you get to see what you're up against. We know these things exist. We know these strategies and tactics exist, but we rarely get to see them firsthand or get to understand how they fit together and who's doing the drive, who's the motorman behind it, or whatever. So the city wants a project, or government wants a project, or a private entity wants a project done. This group of people come in as facilitators and moderators, and I want to say agitators, because what happens is that it leaves the community 90% of the time frustrated that I've witnessed, not getting the answers. And so it's to get the developer what they want, the project that is being proposed. So we've talked extensively about the Kauai Dairy and the dairy there that was proposed, and we've talked about the fines that were issued by the courts for this. But if you listen to this tape that I'm going to play, a recording, this is of Amy Hennessy. She's a spokesperson for Ulupono, and we're going to try and see if we can get that late, and it'll take 10 minutes or so, and that'll be the basis for this, the background for this conversation we'll have.
Aloha kākou. I'm Amy Hennessy. I'm the Director of Communications for Ulupono Initiative, and I skipped over a few of my slides because in listening to everybody, I'm thinking I want to change a little bit of how I talk about our project, because I took it more from a narrative of sort of the history of how we got to where we are. So forgive me if I kind of skip around a little bit. So if you're not familiar with Ulupono Initiative, we are an impact investment company. And what that means is that we take private equity, money from our founder, to try to make a difference for our community in several key areas. One is local food production. One is renewable energy. Another is waste reduction. And then we've just started taking a look at how we can better manage water. So we do those investments through a series of for-profit investments in companies that are working in those areas, but also grants to nonprofits that are working in those areas. So Hawaii Dairy Farms began as an investment for us. We had a partner who had a project, that we thought was going to be really great for our community. We recognize that from 1984, we've slowly given away our ability to produce our own milk. And so one of the areas that we see as an opportunity for improvement for our community is increased production of protein for the folks who do consume them. We recognize there are portions of the population that do not. But for those who do, we wanted to give them fresh, healthy options that were produced locally. So as the project progressed, the development partner needed to step back a little bit. We believed so much in the project that we took the front position. Typically, we are not developers, so it was a little bit of a learning process for us to enter into bringing this farm to fruition, but we partnered with experts who knew how to do that, and so we moved forward. So a little bit about the dairy model. So we wanted to do something that was more sustainable. So typically folks, when they think about dairy, it's a feedlot model where you have cows that are in a barn. They live there, they eat there, they go into another barn, they're milked, and then they are taken back to that barn and they hang out there. They might be put out on pasture when they're not milking for a few months, and then they go back into the milk cycle and they're back in production in that barn. So we wanted to try to do a little bit of a different model where cows are out on pasture all day long. The only time they're in the barn is when they're being milked, and then they go back out. The model is more sustainable for the economy, but it's also more sustainable for the environment. The reason it's more sustainable for the economy, when dairies went away, part of it was the cost of input. So whether it was the cost to import feed or the cost to import fertilizer, relies on fuel. And so it's very expensive. So we want to try to get away from that by using natural feed and fertilizer. Grass is the feed, fertilizer from the cows, and design the farm in a way that was going to use that in the best way possible. So cows rotate through the farm, everything's done. When we started the process, we said, okay, we need to get out in the community as soon as possible, talk to those folks when we took that development position. So we started doing grassroots meetings with community leaders that we were aware of that might have an interest, Kolo Community Association, Malama Koloa, Malama Mahalapu, different groups that had an interest in that area, to make sure that they were aware of what the project was and try to understand what concerns they had. And then over time, the original proposition was for 2,000 cows, up to 2,000 cows. And that's a really important, that update is really important because until you put cows on land, you don't know exactly what the carrying capacity of that land is. So if you find that 1,500 cows is what's going to work, you don't want to put too much manure, you don't want to put too many cows, so you're going to scale back from your original plan of 2,000. And our intent was to ramp up to that. So when we, my reveal moment. I'm not going with the tea one, I heard you. let's see. So in our conversations with folks, we started to understand there were some really core concerns that were kind of top of mind for all of them. One was the number of cows that were proposed for the project, what the impact of the cows would be in terms of manure on the property, flies that might come because of the animal production, and the odor associated with that manure. So we said, okay, we hear you. So we actually moved to change the model of the farm to up to 699, which is a weird number, get that. But for those of you who are familiar with permit process, it was a really key number for us because it's a threshold. So if you go over 699 cows, then you need to go back out to the community and re-engage them in the process and the conversation about whether or not it makes sense for you to expand your project to anything over that number. So we gated it with that intention. We also, we have a neighbor who is a hotel, and they were not excited about our project. And they chose to file a lawsuit against us, which was unfortunate. And so we decided, we'd actually started to make this decision prior to the filing of the lawsuit, but then it really made a lot of sense for us to voluntarily enter into the EIS process. We did that, even though Department of Health actually, there were differing opinions in Department of Health. Some folks said this is a good idea, this will help engage everybody in the process. Others didn't think it was a good idea, didn't want us to do it. We thought it was a good way for us to engage with the community, to help them understand a little bit more about the project, the promise of the project, how it could be good for the community, and so we decided to enter into that process. So, speaking about dividing people up into groups, so when we did our scoping meeting, and I see some of our community is here, and that's great, when we did our scoping meeting, we put a lot of thought into how we could get folks to engage in that process, and we did do breakout groups, and we did that intentionally because we wanted to make sure that every single person in that room had an opportunity to engage and to provide their questions and comments so that we could capture all of that information and use it as we were developing the EIS. So we had different corners that were based on the different topic areas of concern, and we included a cultural corner too. So anybody who had questions about archaeology, any cultural impacts in the area, you could go and talk to folks who were there. We had experts in each corner from our team that could interpret, and then we had recorders. And we made sure that as things were written down, it was like, okay, we want to make sure we've captured this. Is this accurate? Because we didn't want to have anybody feel like they were misinterpreted, misunderstood. And then we posted all of that on our website. So we tried to make our website a repository for the timeline, the process, and the information that people wanted to know. So then the consultants went and they did their work. And they came back with the draft EIS, which outlines all of the science behind all of the different things. And through that process, we also, in the conversation, we also included best management practices that were above and beyond the requirements in terms of setbacks to ensure that the manure was not going to move across 50 feet into a waterway, that we were going to have GPS-controlled irrigation systems that were going to shut off within so many feet of an open water source to ensure that any irrigation that might have manure in it is not in those areas. And our effluent ponds. So even though we downsized the project to 699, we maintained the size of the design of the ponds for the 2,000 cows. So that gave us an overabundance of storage and ability to manage. And we also added in a containment berm. So we tried to really address the concerns of the community that we heard in that process. We received a bunch of comments, a whole lot of comments, and so our consultants then worked on responding to those comments to the draft. We wound up having 9 volumes. Some of the volumes were exclusive to response to attorneys, and so to the comments about litigation, I should say we were also being sued by a community group. That came up during the EIS process on a different matter and related to the farm. And unfortunately, I think that was limiting in our ability to engage with the folks who were the most vocally opposed to the project because you can't really sit down and have an open conversation with them when you're in active litigation. So I think that was unfortunate in terms of the timing, the process, and all of that. So we also received some criticism. I'm sharing with you all of it. We also received some criticism about how we handled the comments. Because of the volume of comments, there were I can't remember the exact number, but there were several hundred comments that we received, we spent a lot of time talking with OQC, with our consultants, with our attorneys about how do we handle these responses to comments. So we did batch some of the responses because the items were so similar that we sort of did like, okay, you have questions about manure, so here's everything you ever want to know about manure, and then some. It's found on these pages, and that's kind of how we chose to address it. We also, based on our attorney's interpretation of the administrative rules, we responded to substantive comments. When we submitted the final, lastly, we were, because of the number of volumes that we had, we did queue up on the comment letters in the volumes. Otherwise, we would have had probably 12 to 15 volumes. And so we were trying to be kind to the environment, not necessarily kill trees, understanding that there are PDFs and you can zoom in, and if you want specific ones, you could request and we would provide your comments specifically in a larger format. So we had that. So when we submitted the final, there were in the attorney letters some really interesting additional questions that were not necessarily pertaining to the content of the EIS, but they were related to things about the project. And so our consultants did a fair amount of work to respond to that, winding up doing basically additional scientific reports in response to, so that's part of the reason why the volumes were so large. We got criticized for that too. Because they said it was additional science, they didn't get a chance to look at it, and it was very upsetting to them, and we understand that. But it's the nature of the process. So we're here to talk about how can we fix the process, because at the end of the day, let me finish the process, and then I'll get to the end of the day. So then we had the EIS, the final EIS, under review during the crazy part of the legislative session. And we knew that the folks who were the Department of Health, who had never been the receiving agency of an EIS prior, they probably needed some additional time. So we asked them for an extension because we wanted to give them enough time to really review the content and hopefully be able to get everything out of it that they needed to make determination. We got a letter from OEQC about a week prior to that extended deadline that said that they were recommending to the Department of Health non-acceptance, and it was around the response to comments. They felt that we had not adequately addressed them according to what was in the administrative rules because we only responded to substantive comments, and in some cases we had bashed them. That was surprising to us because we had been in consultation with them. We had a meeting with them to try to understand. It became clear in that meeting that there was no clear path. And so we decided at that moment to withdraw the EIS, to regroup, to hopefully sit down with the Department of Health to try to understand where they might find it deficient in terms of addressing all of the disclosures required. And then go back in. Okay, so now the end of the day. What we discovered, we entered into this process voluntarily because we felt like it was a way for us to be able to better explain the project, more fully address the issues of concern to the community, and really kind of have a conversation with them. That was naive on our part because the process didn't necessarily allow for that to happen. What we found that was frustrating about the scoping meeting, for instance, is that you can't really answer questions, you can just take questions. And so people come into those meetings with an expectation that you're going to give them information of value, and that wasn't necessarily the way that you can handle that meeting. So I think if there's a way to fix that so that people at least feel like they've got something when they leave that room, apart from they've been through this brain dump, I think that would be really great. And then, you know, I think just improving the process overall in terms of how you can submit comments, how you can respond to comments. I think there's a lot of technology that we could utilize that would allow for that better interaction. And I know OEQC is working on some of that currently. So anyway, I'm really thrilled that we're here to have this conversation because I think there is work we can do to improve it. And I hope that this was helpful for you.
Amy, thanks very much. You know, Peter, in his opening charge, basically challenged us to come up with ways to look at public processes critically and suggest some structural and organizational improvements. And I think your case highlights the need and imperative for some of those, and I think your own suggestions, in fact, about how some of those things might be implemented would be right on point. So we are now preparing for our final presentation. A quick question.
So the environmental health group was in charge of it, Kipkaoka, is sort of managing the process. And then there's clean water, wastewater, safe drinking water. They're all involved in the review. So I'll say that again. So her question was?
The room, use the perception, use the other devices on the table. Push the right thing.
Oh, okay. So the question was, who at DOH received the EIS? So when we started the process, I should clarify that to you, it was under the Abercrombie administration. So it was Gary Gill who would have been the one receiving it, and he made the Environmental Planning Office the one who sort of managed Laura McIntyre. And then when the administration changed, it became Keith Kawoka. And so he's been the one who's kind of managing the different departments that are involved in the review. And the reason the Department of Health was chosen as the one to receive it is because the majority of the permits required for the operation of the dairy fall under the Department of Health's purview.
We may have a couple of questions about this case. I think we have time for one more question, and then we're going to continue with our presentation. But we recognize that there is a fair bit of interest in this case. Go ahead.
I just wondered if she could explain why the court threw out all of the permits based on inaccuracy of the Department of Health, and why the Federal Clean Act, Water Act, also found against the dairy. I mean, there's so much that you did not share.
Is this a question, or are
I want to ask her if
it's fine to ask a question. We're not here to adjudicate or litigate the case.
Sure, absolutely. So the court case around the EIS was predicated.
Okay, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. That was Miss Amy Hennessy with Ulupono, or Kauai Dairy Farms, who were proposing to put a dairy up, and we apologize for the quality of the recording, but we try to do our best, and we'll see if we have Miss Hammerquist on the phone for a moment. We'll talk, but as we go on, I don't want to be vague here and confusing, but it's about public participation. And you heard us talk about HCR, House Concurrent Resolution 120, about 2 or 3 weeks ago. This has its tentacles in that and its birthplace in this effort to construct a dairy on Kauai. But we'll talk at length now. Caller, good morning. Thank you for calling. Who do I have? Caller, good morning. Thank you for calling. Who do I have online?
Hello, Carol. How are you?
I'm fine. You have anything to say about the subject we're talking about? I guess he didn't. got to think fast on your feet, my friend, if you keep. But it's, thank you for listening to the Carol Cox Show. I mean, it's an absolute pleasure to know that you're out there listening and giving us the time to acknowledge us. And you must think that your friends are listening. So anyway, thanks again. It's an interruption, but we'll tolerate it. But caller, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello, Carol.
Yes.
This is Bridget. I'm back. I'm sorry. It just, for some reason, I wasn't working.
Oh, no problem. You have some noise in the background there. Are you?
Well, my phone as well, so I apologize.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, did you listen to the...
I listened to all of it. Yes, it was a good refresher.
And what do you think... I said that it had its tentacles and birthplace in the HCR 120 or the HCR 120 House Concurrent Resolution that was proposed. Meantime, while you're fighting them, or I shouldn't say fighting them, you're making sure that they do what's right and consistent with law and by the community and the environment. And they were busy in court as well, because you took them to court and challenged them. So did the Hyatt Hotel. Am I correct?
Yes, you are.
On Kauai. And then in turn, they took a substantial blow based on the court ruling. But in her presentation, she represented, my take from that was that it was all about the public demanding too much, and the public was a hindrance, and the public was unreal in their requests. And but I'll let you, I don't want to characterize this as the wrong way, but... Go ahead.
No,
what was your take?
That one listener's question where she said that a lot was left out was probably the most accurate capture of her presentation. You know, I think if you're a developer and you go out into a community and you begin your development, you begin your construction, and the construction you begin requires permits, and you don't apply for them. They didn't even apply for them when they started. And then when the state received our concerns as a community, they said, hey, you do need these applications to be filed, and you really aren't supposed to construct that farm until you've got permits that have been approved. And they kept developing and constructing the farm beginning in January of 2014 all the way through June of 2015 when we filed our Clean Water Act violation. And, I mean, we were 18 months trying to get them to do the right thing. It's not like the community didn't try. We had a stream that flows into the ocean at Mahalapu, and the name of the stream is the Waiopili, heavily polluted. I mean, not just minimally polluted, heavily polluted.
Mm-hmm.
And it had much more mud in it and rock that was coming down into the ocean. We had a brown plume out at the sea that went all the way to Poipu Beach, which is a very popular beach, very heavily attended. I mean, people could visibly see what was happening. And meanwhile, they're excavating. They're starting to dig their effluent pond. They trenched the whole area. They put in lots of irrigation pipes. They were trying to establish grasses. They took out every tree and shrub in a 500-acre parcel of land. Every tree, and some of the trees were over 30 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an area where the Nene goose nests and reproduces. The Newell shearwaters are in there. The Kaloa duck, the Hawaiian coot, our owl, apua. You know, it's a pretty valley. And it's much loved by island people. So we weren't objecting for no reason. But if you listen to her presentation,
mm-hmm.
you don't get a sense that there was any grounds or basis for the litigation that was filed. And the Hyatt had a state court case going. They filed their case actually well before the community case that was in the Clean Water Act case that we filed in federal court. But as the court processes go, ours came up on the docket sooner, and we had a summary judgment motion decided in our favor in December of 2016, and the court ruled that they had polluted, that they had constructed without necessary permits, and held that the only thing that was reserved and left for trial was the amount of discharge into the stream and the ocean that had happened, and that was going to be a matter for expert opinion.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the dairy farm entered into settlement negotiations with us and finally agreed to a long list. It's on our website. It's friendsofmahalapu.org. But they agreed to a long list of prohibited activity that they would not do. They stopped the that is when they really stopped the development. Not when we filed the suit, not before we filed the suit, but more than a year after the suit was filed. We're mm-hmm. talking December of 16, January of 17.
And they characterize it as they volunteered it, but the courts ruled that they needed it. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they did.
I volunteered to do what the law requires me to do. I guess the result would be you end up losing your case, wouldn't you?
Well, if they hadn't done anything wrong, we certainly wouldn't have prevailed. And as you're aware, after the consent decree was entered and it became a consent judgment, and there was this long list of prohibitions that they could no longer do out there, there was no point in our going to trial to prove how much pollution, the quantity, and try and get a big judgment that was then going to go on to the EPA coffers. That there really wasn't. Our job as a community was we wanted it stopped. We wanted them to get under the lights of day and let the community and the state know what they were putting in there and what it was going to involve and what it was likely going to discharge into the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
They're only 0.6 mile upslope from the ocean, very close to the ocean. And the ocean they're very close to is the kind of the starting beach. Mahalalepu Beach is the starting beach for all the south shore of Kauai, which is a very popular area. So, and a beautiful area with live reefs and lots of reef fish and limu. So, you know, it's where people surf and swim and play. And it's just, you know, not a great idea to think of all this pollution going out into the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I noticed in her presentation, she mentioned that they'd gone down to 699 cows. And every time I hear that, I get angry, Carol, because she doesn't add 699 pregnant cows. Because the pregnancy is a requirement to produce milk. And so if they would tell the whole story, you would understand it's not just 699 cows. Not only that, but when they filed their final EIS with the state, that was the first time we appreciated, because we're not dairy farmers either, that they have to have what's called a support herd. They have to have a big herd of cattle where there's cows at rest, cows that have not yet been impregnated, bulls, heifers growing up, to resupply the herd, because to keep 699 dairy cows in production, making milk, in other words, there's mm-hmm. a support herd that's needed because cows get sick, so you have to pull one cow out and put another cow in the line. And so this idea that this area, 0.6 mile from the ocean, was only going to have 699 cows is truly a falsehood. And mm-hmm. and that was our biggest problem with them all the way along. Just like when they got in this room and made this presentation and talked about public participation and
right.
there's a way we could get them the information. They didn't try to get us the information.
And that's why I want to now focus on this meeting that we attended, where you were in attendance there at UH. How we say that it was public participation in a polarized era. My take from that was that the public is so demanding and unrealistic and just ridiculously absurd in their requests, and they take a position and they're just there like concrete. But in fact, your situation, you weren't getting the information timely. or what did you experience in there, and do you believe that this meeting would have added any light or made things better, or what? What's your takeaway from that meeting that we participated in?
Well, I attended the meeting because it was sponsored by Ulupono. It was being paid for by Ulupono and Civil Beat, and of course, both Ulupono and Civil Beat are owned by Piero Midyar. So it's really the same man putting up the money
mm-hmm.
for a symposium to deal with public participation in a polarized area. So we wanted to go hear what they had to say, because there really has been, in her public statements, because she is their spokesperson, Ms. Hennessy has definitely painted the public as unreasonable and no grounds, and we don't understand why, and what is it that we haven't given them, you know. And in reality, they turned over 30-year-old rainfall records to the state that just happened to be before a very serious hurricane, so they left that event out. Their draft EIS said that the two hurricanes, Eva and Iniki, passed by Kauai. They literally put that in print. They used that phrase, passed by Kauai.
Mm-hmm.
And we have that if anybody wants to read it. But can you imagine how people who lived along the coast and had their homes decimated by those hurricanes, and the eye of the hurricane, there's pictures of it going right over Maile'ali, right across the island, a swath that just cut, it mowed down North Shore, South
mm-hmm.
Shore, Lihue. That hurricane hit this whole island. It didn't pass by Kauai. It smashed into Kauai.
So
it cost millions and millions of dollars of damage.
So there,
if you had a dairy on the coast when that hits, just 6/10 of a mile from the ocean, you're going to have millions of pounds of manure and cows floating out in the sea.
Right.
And how long is it going to take mm-hmm. for that to recover?
Well, they at this meeting, this seminar, and I really want to, you know, my interest is to convey to the public and demonstrate, when you participate in these processes, be aware that it's contrived, most of it. It's orchestrated, most of it, and it limits us, the public, in participation, and that the cards are stacked. In this instance, this presentation that she made, I thought, was rather awkward and out of place, because it didn't allow for any rebuttal. And as you say, the gentleman said, we're not going to adjudicate this, but if you allow someone 30 minutes to stand up and profess or convey inaccurate information or incomplete information, and this thing is about the polarization of polarized era of the public, there's something wrong with that picture and the integrity
I totally agree, because the people in the room weren't given any information to let them know that there was some real merit
mm-hmm.
to why the community was not enthused and backing the project.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole sense of the seminar, you know, after being at the symposium for the 2-day period, the takeaway I had was that, if you don't mind my sharing, is that everybody on the panel was pretty much a regulator.
Mm-hmm.
Or somebody in industry that had their project not make it. And
mm-hmm.
particularly the gentleman that spoke for the University of Hawaii, Dr. Chun.
Gary Chun, is it?
Yeah, Greg Chun, the 30-millimeter telescope. I sat out there and listened as he defined and described how you can manipulate the public and don't let them speak or give their concerns, but rather pose questions to them, get them off topic and get them to answer your questions. And this thing of dividing up the room and making people go to different stations where they get to express their concerns, but they, even Amy admitted, they never get answers to them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man up there that writes it down on a pad, and it's sort of a divide and conquer effort, where people, good people, go give 2 hours or 3 hours of their evening and say, you know, I want to understand how you're going to keep that wet manure from going into all the ditches that run through your property, that ultimately are drained by one central stream. How are you going to keep the manure out of that stream that just happens to go over the freshwater aquifer that filled our drinking water wells, and then it goes to the ocean where people are swimming? Mm-hmm. How are you going to contain it? And there were people who asked questions like that. And there was a man up there that wrote it down on a pad. And the pad got carried away, and we never heard an answer to that question.
And so the takeaway here is that government proposes projects, private industry proposes projects. There's this unique, it's not unique, I shouldn't use that term, it's because it's been creeping up on us. And that is, you get a team of moderators, quote, consultants, and they basically say to the developer or the party that wants this project done, we'll get it done for you. We'll employ these tactics, and we'll basically treat the public like mushrooms, keep them in the dark and feed them, you know, BS. And that's basically what it is. And then to come back and add insult to injury, to openly advertise something as a public participation, which the public has to pay for, by the way, it was not something, in my opinion.
No, in fact, many people in the room commented, where is the public?
Yeah, where is the public? Ray Soon was shocked.
If you wanted to be there, it cost you $185. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of the public that's a stopping point right there for a day and a half to mm-hmm. sit and listen. And so really what happened was most of the people there were from state or county government. They were learning how to conduct public meetings that are required by the law. And public participation in development process and the use of public science from the public sector, has been recognized by Congress for a long time as a valuable tool. And it's real simple. That's because the people who live there know the area best. And you might come in as a developer and have a great idea, but you might not understand something that's unique to that area that's going to impact your project. You know, when we got, just to use as an example, when we got looking into the dairy thing, someone, I didn't know it at the time, and I've lived here, you know, the better part of my life, and my parents are buried here, you know, and we all went to school here, and I never knew where our drinking water wells were. They're in Maha'olepu. And so someone said that one day, and I said, really, we better find out where they are in relation to where the dairy is, because I think manure, untreated with lots of bacteria and nitrates, is considered a contaminating source for wells. And sure enough, it is. It's actually in the state water assessment report that is the SWAP report that's on every island. It's one of the lead contaminating activities is dairy waste. So I contacted our water department, asked to speak to whoever it was that took care of the wells at Maha'olepu. The engineer called me back, and I said who I was and that I was just kind of studying the situation with a bunch of community members, and we were curious as to where the wells were in location to the dairy that was proposed to go in, the big dairy. He said, what dairy? Now, this was more than a year into their development, Carol.
And they hadn't shared that information.
They'd never even contacted the water department.
Right. Hold on.
So the gentleman asked me if I had a copy of their plan that they'd filed, and I said, yes, they filed it with the state. In fact, this is their third plan, their third version. And he said, do you have it electronically? And I said, yes. He said, you send that to me, and I'll diagram on there, I'll show you where the wells are in relation to the maps that they have in their plan. Mm-hmm. And he did that. It turns out that our two primary drinking water wells that are the sole source of fresh water for all of Poipu and most of Kaloa were within 750 feet of the farm where they intend to dump manure sludge solids.
And that, there was nothing to say that it wouldn't migrate once in ground. It won't migrate.
No, it would. It would. Yeah. That's how it works. I mean,
right.
It goes down into the ground. And in that part, I was trying to figure out, why would they put it on the side of the dairy property? Why would they put it on the side closest to the well?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that's one of the few areas of the site that has well-draining soil. soil where it'll perk, which is what you want manure to do. It's kind of like the,
right.
You know, the idea of a septic tank. A cesspool is a better example, where they put it deep in the ground, and then it perks down through soil and rock. And then by the time it migrates into any water, the idea is hopefully the bacteria has been addressed and it's dead and the water doesn't get contaminated. This thing wasn't going to be anything like a household septic tank, though, because it's going to have, even with their 699 pregnant cows, and excluding the babies and the support herd and the bulls, just taking that 699 figure, using only that, which is what they try to isolate and do, there's 70,000 pounds, or 2 million pounds a month, 70,000 pounds a day of wet manure,
right.
2 million pounds of wet manure a month going on the ground, because all of it was designed for land application.
So getting back to the...
it was going to be there, and it was going to go in the ground.
Right, I understand.
And then it would migrate down into the aquifer.
Right.
And then from the aquifer to our well.
Right. But
nitrates, you can't get out of the water.
Right.
You
we've talked about that a couple of times. What I'm trying to get is make sure that the listeners understand that with all of this in place and all of these things that were overlooked or were not addressed, this process that they're subjecting the people to or proposing to orchestrate this effort when you have a project, this is the perfect example where many things cause concern with the public. They go in and comment, and Ulupono or Amy Hennessy is characterizing the public's opposition or the issues raised as being unreal, unreasonable, and irrational or something to that effect. So that's the important thing.
Fear-mongering, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Hold on. I'm going to see if there's someone. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll be right back.
Okay.
Caller, thank you for calling. You have a comment, a question?
Yeah. I was curious. I think what had been mentioned prior was, I guess it was that that event about democracy. I think it was at UH or something.
Mm-hmm.
The one that the... I guess your guest had mentioned,
right.
I guess he attended, something about democracy,
it wasn't. It was a polarization and openness,
right.
And transparency.
Yeah, I found it hilarious that they had this event that's about greater democracy for the public, but they're going to charge $185, because I think I saw it promoted in Civil Beat.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to charge $185 for people to attend. I'm like, if you're for openness in terms of democracy, why are you charging nearly $200 to attend some seminar or an event like this?
And navigate yourself through the early morning traffic to get to UH to pay the
right.
parking and all. It's quite conducive to public gathering,
mean,
right?
It's ridiculous. Because I got invited to some event, I think it was Ocala Public Square, about voting.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-event. Actually, it wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It was also, I think Civil Beat also covered it. I don't know the other...
Yeah, Civil Beat was there. Think Tech was there as a media. And,
yeah. But it actually wasn't bad. I mean, I thought it was mostly, talk for the sake of talk. But, the people they had, the panelists, and some of the discussion, actually wasn't bad. And that's a free event. You're going to pay $185... But that was simply about why voting patterns are low in Hawaii and what needs to be done to get them up.
Right.
Here you have an event that's a seminar or something along that line about democracy, something even, supposedly greater. And you're charging a bunch of money, not a bunch of money, but a considerable amount of money for it.
Mm-hmm.
The irony is just fascinating to me. It's just indicative of the lack of democracy.
Right.
From what your guest had stated, of what was stated there at this event.
Well, hold that thought. I'm going to try to answer this one other call, and we're going to talk more about this, and I'm going to play another audio in the next hour that's related to this subject as well. So can you hold on or call back?
Call back later.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye.
Aloha. Caller, thank you for calling. Go ahead. Hello.
Hello. I just got into your show. I forgot your phone number.
No problem.
Is this a lady who's against the dairy that proposed to be built on Kauai?
Well, when you say against the dairy, this is the radio host who's against the dairy, especially when the courts gave a staggering 506,000 reasons to not allow the dairy to proceed, and that was in some things that the courts ruled. So if you want to equate that to say the courts have been diminished to nothing and just a game, I would say let's see what the courts rule.
Well,
and then when we say, well, hold on, when we say against, just the characterization there, against. No, these people successfully sued, took it to the courts. The courts made a ruling, and we must respect that. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I was saying is that obviously the people on Kauai, most of them probably don't care because
I can't say that. I can't. They got an extent.
People, because when they wanted to put the super ferry, the people of Kauai got together and they stopped the super ferry. I think if
they stopped it on law.
Having the dairy there,
hold on.
I think they should get together like they did for the super ferry and go ahead and protest and show that we don't want this dairy here.
Well, see, that's the misnomer and the mischaracterization again. They went to court. These are civil-minded people. The shuttle that was coming in, right, the boat you're talking about, the super ferry, ultimately it lost because of the legal issues, nothing to do with people objection and anger and what have you. And so when you say the people on Kauai, probably we should stay away from that.
I know the history. The people of Kauai did not want the ferry coming there.
I know.
They did not want people from this island going there and fishing in their waters, which was one of the primary reasons. We have the same problem with Walter Riddy on Molokai. He's another guy who keeps cruise ships and millionaires from coming up there because they don't want anybody coming on this island. They don't think they belong to this state. They think they're some foreign country.
Well, maybe they took them play from the old playbook. If they're not being served by the government entity, I'm not encouraging them to do what they do, but maybe let's look from their standpoint, to their vantage. Maybe if the government isn't serving them right and serving as an insulator to do what's right and regulate and monitor, then you have to take it in your own hands. So therefore, you lose control as far as government or you and I is sitting back watching this. It's like chaos. But they are expressing themselves. That's the point. Participation, publicly being honest, giving the information up front, a healthy decision can be made. But when part of the information is withheld, another portion of it is behind closed doors, you're greasing the hands and the palms of someone else in government.
I understand all this,
yeah.
But on this island of Oahu, we've had huge dairies in the Waianae area, and we have dairies in the Waimanalo area.
Right.
There was no complaint about the manure being deposited on the grounds there.
Well, no, they are complaining.
We wanted local milk.
Okay. Well, that's good. And so I would say that you may not hear any complaints, but the average Joe that goes fishing now looks at the coral and looks at the habitat and say, where did it go? So, we did have a lot of dairies and what have you, and I think that's why we have our demise now today, and that's why people want to go and encroach and poach on the other islands, and these people said, nah, not on our turf, and I can understand that. But we'll be back in the next hour.
Well, the dairies folded here because of the cost of the real estate. We had dairies here long before you ever came here, and they survived, and I've never heard any reports about ocean contamination and whatever.
Well, call back in the next hour.
We'll have contamination in the Punalu area from all those cesspools,
right.
And they haven't, solved that problem yet.
Maybe, we got to go.
I just wanted to bring this out.
Thank you.
I think if the people of Kauai did not want to do it, I think they should do what they did with the super ferry and go out and get the numbers and protest.
They are. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that's a misnomer, folks, when people say that this is wrong. First of all, just the demand for milk in the market and the competition and other sources of milk may have caused it and drove down the price, and that these dairies couldn't survive. So we're just taking a cookie out of the cookie jar and saying this is the way they all taste or this is what fits them all. There are many reasons that the dairies failed here. And also could have been poor management. Could have been the family matriarch dies or the head of the family dies and the family immediately wants to sell because they need to pay for the condos in San Francisco or Vegas. So let's be real about it. We'll be back shortly. And Bridget, if you're there, give me a call back in the next hour. We'll be back. Aloha. This is the Carol Cox Show.
It's time for the Carol Cox Show right here at K108. If you have questions or comments for Carol, our number here is 524-1080, 524-1080. And now, here's Carol.
Good morning again, and welcome back to the Carol Cox Show, the second half. The 524-1080 is obviously not the right number, 888-5204. And we're having some phone problems, but if you be patient and what have you, I'll be able to patch you in. So anyway, we're talking about a number of things and public participation, public access. And most of these projects that we were talking about in the early hour, they somehow will end up on state lands or private lands that end up affecting state lands or population or what have you. And we want to make sure that we try and get the best product, something that's suitable, that blends in with the community, that's compatible or complements the existing and not be as disruptive. So what I'm going to do is play now, and I'm really adamant about this public participation, transparency, because ultimately it is about our government. When our government is being cajoled and courted and badgered or lend themselves to the contractors and consultants and to get the product that they want, then we must sound the alarm. We must say something is wrong here. Bring everything out, and if it's tedious, it is a process, long and drawn out, but at least the public gets to participate. You know, what is too many comments? Or the same comments. If you have 1,000 people write the same comment, but if it's a fact, then you can't omit it. But anyway, we're going to play Mr. Ray Soon. He participated as a panelist. And I want you to listen to, you know, the rules are the rules. The Sunshine Act is the Sunshine Act. But Mr. Soon, it appears that he believes that he can take the liberty and has taken the liberty of taking and removing things out of public forum, even though they are public interest, were in public forum. He openly boasts, and I don't know why he felt that he would be able to say this. Maybe he was amongst friends, and to describe how he has actually pulled things off the table, go behind closed doors, and render decisions without public participation, even though the public were initially involved. So listen in, and Ray Soon, former City and County Managing Director under Kirk Caldwell.
To Jim's answer, which is when you were in the governor's in the mayor's office, you were put in the very position of having to grapple with the public's right to know and your need to take things behind closed doors. So did the media help or hinder you in your efforts, and what was that balancing act like?
In all honesty, I didn't really wrestle with that issue that much. if I felt that an issue wasn't ripe, and that bringing it into the public realm, I would find a way not to. To some extent, public servants really want to do a good job. They really do. I don't know very many who are there for the paycheck. If you're there for the paycheck, you're in the wrong. You really do believe in public service. You really believe in what you're doing. And so, you know, you a little bit got to trust. I wish I didn't see the initial presentation yesterday about how much of the public trusts public officials. And I understand that was incredibly low. But if you want good, effective government, to some extent, you got to trust us to do the best job we can. Yes, you watch, and yes, you confirm and verify. But you need to have a little bit of trust here. And so I worked personally. You're asking me personally. I can answer for all public service. Personally, I worked under the principle that I was doing the best job I could. And if I felt that information leaked to the public was going to diminish the effectiveness of what we're trying to do or the result, if I didn't have to give it up because I may have had to, then I would keep it to myself or keep it within the conversation. There's no doubt that there is information that the law requires to be made public, and I would be the last person to want to put to avoid meeting the letter of the law. But in the gray areas, to some extent, I trust myself.
Do any of you have questions for each other?
And not so much a questions as one of the things you wanted to talk about were ideas going forward or ideas of what could improve the process. And I'd like to just suggest a couple of them. One is, there's a difference between the long processes of deliberation that most of us have been talking about and the short ones, the one-day meetings, maybe the two-day meetings. I think those short-term processes, we need to build in time for closing the door, letting your ear down, and just talking. So that's this one. The second is we really do need a longhouse here in Hawaii. We need a place where we can come together, leave our differences outside the door, sit down, find common ground, and talk about issues. We need that safe harbor that others have talked about, that safe place. Not just safe time, but an actual safe place. That would be great. The third, maybe my most passionate suggestion is, most of you are too young to remember, but there's some of you who do. HIMAG in the 60s. HIMAG was an institution that was established by the state government for the training of mid-level, especially mid-level civil servants. It was really important for the training of deputy directors and directors as well. It was designed around Massachusetts' program for certifying their secretaries and undersecretaries. And I think we need to bring that back. I think we need the education, the constant education and re-education of people who run our public departments. And one leg of that education should be conversations around how you manage the public process and how you engender more participation that is open and transparent and productive. But we need to find the money to get back to that. Most private appointees come from private industry. They're not used to sitting in front of a public conversation. They're not even aware most of the time that they need to have a lot of public involvement. And they get trained, yes, by their staff, but they don't come with the mentality of how important that is. And I think we need to have very specialized training programs. Now, that HIMAG type operation can very much be open to the public as well. For the training of the public, the education of the public in how to participate in public processes. And you could even put both public officials and private people together in those educational settings and test out ideas. I think this is important enough, especially to the elevation of the quality of public servants and the elevation of the esteem that we hold for them. If you want good government, you've got to invest in good government.
Okay, that's Mr. Ray Soon. A portion of that is in the interest of time. Clearly, there's a lot more. He talks about the Kahuku, purchasing the facility at Kahuku, the golf course. But again, this thing is about transparency and openness, open government and public participation. But he sits there and then says, well, he trusts himself. He will remove some of these things out of the open debate, of public forum, and go behind closed doors. That's such a liberty that I don't believe that any man should be or woman should be afforded. It's either open door policy, open doctrine, transparency consistent with UIPA, Uniform Information Practices Act, the Sunshine Act. You can't take upon yourself and apply based on project, depending on projects, and the affordable homes material that he talks about, and I'll play that later in another show, but it's an eye-opener. Caller, thank you for calling. Go ahead. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, this is Eileen Ketchloyan calling.
Hi, Eileen. How are you?
I am doing just fine. I've been listening to your show, and I think that an overview of what they were actually trying to accomplish at the conference might be a good idea. I listened to four different people who spoke there on shows on ThinkTech, and they basically said the point of the conference was to come up with ideas for legislation.
Uh-huh.
And so the fact that they didn't have any of the public participation going on at it, how could they come up with legislation that was fair?
Uh-huh.
Or was this legislation all for Ulupono, as they were the sponsors of it? You know, they couldn't get their EIS through because it was poorly done, and they decided that they could just change the laws. And they've proceeded to try to change the laws.
On the HCR 120.
Yes, that's right. And now they're holding a conference to see what other laws they can come up with to change.
Uh-huh. So they... It's like a baseball player in the batter's box. He get nine balls a strikeout, get nine strikes rather than three.
Right. If you can't hit the ball right, you just change the rules of the game.
Right. Yeah. You go and you have the umpire to tell the pitcher to throw a little softer or a little slower.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Ulupono, if you go to their website, they have policy, a tab called policy, and under that they have all the legislation that they're supporting.
Uh-huh.
And if you go back on some of that legislation and you look at the old forms of it, you'll see Ulupono was actually the initiator by getting someone the same people over and over again from the House to bring the bill forward for them.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what they did on the HCR 120.
Well, as we saw that the composition of that, one of the panels was Ed Case, former congressman, senator of Hawaii. And then you have Mitch Dollier, who is now CASA Foundation, who is quite active in projects involving the state and development, what have you. So this was how to fatten the public up, basically. I'm going to gross people out, but take them to slaughter. You know, get them right. Filled with, gorged with their ideas and their information, limited to what's going to push their agenda. And basically, we the public be left to fend for ourselves because the government is sitting there in bed with them, hiring them. And, you know.
The irony on this conference is that it was full of people from different agencies of the government. So the taxpayer paid the $185
mm-hmm.
for them to go to that conference. So the public who's being told that they can't have the input into the project are paying to have Ulupono preach to the agency.
Yes, thank you. Because when Ray Soon asked, he indicated that, well, how many people, there are no people in here from government agencies or something to that effect. And then many of them raise their hands, and I'm thinking, isn't that funny? They pay, use government money, the people's money, to come in to listen to a program be disseminated to them, information inaccurate, incomplete, by consultants and managers and moderators, and you understand? And then in turn, these people are going to go back on the streets or to their office and apply this half-baked education perpetuated by Ulupono.
Yeah.
That
was exactly the point of the conference.
Yeah.
And to get legislation.
Yeah.
And to just be able to slide their projects past these agencies with more ease.
It doesn't surprise me to what length they will go, and they reinvent themselves, so to speak. Each occasion, you tell them no, it's like Jason the Friday the 13th. You slap him down here, and you turn in the next 15 minutes in the video, he's back again. But this is really unique in that the government entities and former government employees and congressmen are sitting there participating in this. It's kind of frightening.
Well, it was interesting that the one fellow that you played, the last one, that he was just making the decision himself for whether or not he should follow the Sunshine Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem I have with that, besides it's illegal, is that does he think the people, the community, the public are idiots?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have higher education levels than he does.
Right.
And that's one of the things that showed up in the Kauai, at the Hawaii Dairy Farm EIS. There were a lot of highly educated people with doctorate degrees in the different parts that were applicable to that EIS. But once they got what they call BAT and got the same comment response as somebody who didn't have an education but mentioned the same subject.
Mm-hmm.
And so their questions weren't ever really specifically answered.
Yeah, you know, one of the other things that got under my skin, but I was there for a purpose of just open mind, and was that the fact that it was took place, the setting, in the Richardson School of Law. I mean, In my opinion, if anybody had any doubt, and here's this forum being held in the Richardson School of Law, that's half the convincing already. You've already sold most of the people, because who would dare pull trickery and skullduggery and go into this setting?
Yeah, I can see that. There was a total sales job, no doubt about it.
And it was people who, I wouldn't have much doubt, but it was people who've already demonstrated wanted something from the government and got their hands in the pocket of the government and buying off some of our politicians. Well, you don't have to buy many of them off. They're cheap anyway, $300, and you can bill on Mauna Kea, you know, take them to lunch or something like that with many of the politicians here, but that's a different show. But anyway, your observations are pretty right on.
Well, thank you, Carol, and thanks for letting me voice my opinion.
All righty. If you have any more...
Okay. Aloha.
Aloha. And I cut that tape short because there's more, and as time goes on, we'll play more. Caller, thank you for holding. Go ahead. Hello?
Carol?
Yes.
Hi, I'm back. It's Bridget.
All righty. Okay, well, we were... Eileen had called, and we were talking about... Eileen Keshlun had called, and we were talking about this project here. And Mr. I don't know if you were able to listen to Ray Soon, but repeatedly he had several, he enumerated them, I think four, he said, that why he believed that he'd think that this process, the Sunshine Act, could be cumbersome or get in the way, or he had learned to navigate it to and take upon himself. He repeated that in different ways, that when there was something that he believed that it was okay to remove it out of public debate, then he would take it behind closed doors and work at his own pace and do whatever he wanted to do with it. Is that appropriate?
No, I mean, I listened to that, and it was it's pretty startling that he made that admission, because basically what he's saying is, as a public servant, getting taxpayer dollars, working on a project that's a public development project, that he's going to decide when to include the public and when not to include the public, totally in violation of the Sunshine Laws and the Freedom of Information Act. And it's, you know, and he said, well, sometimes you don't want to state something publicly because it's not a fully developed idea, and you don't want to sound like you're ill-prepared. But at the same time, I attended a meeting yesterday where they did speak publicly amongst each other right in front of us, and it was great to see that happen because, you know, it was on Friday, I'm sorry, because it was okay if their ideas weren't fully developed and they were developing them as they talked back and forth and as they got public input. That's democracy. That's the way the program's supposed to work.
And the rules already are in place to allow for deliberative practices or behavior that it's exempt. You know, it would frustrate. I mean, it's all that they're saying is already has been addressed. They just have to follow the rules. But the thing is, the rules become cumbersome to them because they never intend to do what's right. There's always some political taint to it, and he was extensive about the incident with the affordable homes, where it took 3 years, 2 years, or something to the effect. This is further on in the conversation, as he participated in the panel, that he went to the mayor, and I will play that, not today, but in that they delayed and withheld information. And
right.
Funny thing is, they can't find money for the affordable homes, but they found $2 billion or $3 billion or $20 billion for a rail. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So I guess that would be one of those situations where it took it behind closed doors and employed the tactics of we'll get this done without the public participation, and we see that.
Yeah, and that last caller you had just before we broke on the hour, you know, we had two dairies on Kauai that did close because of problems with waste once they got up to about 300 cows. And we did have 36 small dairies in Kauai that operated just fine and didn't have runoff into streams or the ocean. And they were along the coast, but they were small enough that the ground could handle the waste. So, you know, there are projects that it's not just because it's Kauai and we don't want something to happen here, as he intimated. There's never been an industrial dairy in the state of Hawaii, and people need to take notice when things like this happen. And, you know, when they're going to put a 30-meter telescope up, and people are concerned because there's already 13 telescopes on the mountain. And when they showed the picture of the mountain at the symposium, this is another sort of sleight-of-hand thing. They showed an old picture of Mauna Kea. You didn't see any of the scars. You didn't see any of the other telescopes that are up there already marring the landscape.
And so this is, you know, it's a sales pitch that I think the public is objecting to. It's like the half-truths, the half-baked information. But trust me, people don't spend their time and contribute their hard-earned dollars unless there's a real serious concern.
Let me ask, you've been around some while now, and you've been a judge, you are a lawyer, and your grandmother an actress. Have you, in your legal travels, have you ever witnessed a person that would openly, in the capacity of Ray Soon, sit and openly describe and admit so casually that he take matters in his own hand and take them off the table when they're public interest? That openly talk about it, meaning go into a forum such as the one at UH. You ever witness anything like that?
No, I never have. I mean, he really did admit that there are times where you just don't share it with the public.
Yeah.
And when he said it, I thought, wow. You know, because he's working for the public.
Yeah.
And he's using public taxpayer dollars. Why does he think there's ever a time where he should be making deals behind closed doors? And he wasn't the only speaker on a panel that intimated that that occurred. I mean, I think the question posed by the facilitator of that panel was, you know, when is it time for public disclosure and when is there a time for privacy?
Right.
Well, if you read the law doesn't contemplate private deals by public officials, because that then almost always is to the detriment of the public.
Uh-huh.
And it gets public officials involved in politics and deal making and, you know, I'll do this for you if you do this for me type thing. And it's, I think legislation in general and the law went a long way to try to avoid that to happen. So for him to sit there and say, well, I just have found that I have to do this at times. And I thought, well, who are you to decide that it's time to do that? I mean, even everything we did in our fight, we put it right up on our webpage. Everything was out there. Every charge we made, every scientific piece of information obtained, it was there. Because our position was, if we're wrong about our facts, we want to know. And that's the whole beauty of democracy, is that if you do keep it open and above board, your ideas can be even better than they are just with what you have in your agency. You'll get public input from smart people, even uneducated people that just are super savvy. I've met many people without educations that are as smart as anybody I ever met with a PhD.
But the hybridization of an open sunshine law, when you start to snip and cut and tuck and only from one side, and that is
decide when it applies and when it doesn't.
Right. It becomes frightening and it leads to chaos, and it does not move closer to the line of democracy. It completely swings the other way, and I see many of the things. In that meeting, that presentation, it was an unhealthy setting. In that, on one hand, it was about the polarization of the public, and yet here's they're prescribing how you can define and deny the public information at just willy-nilly. Just
well, there were just in defense of a few of the speakers. There were a few speakers. In fact, there was a professor from the William Richardson School of Law, who did get up and tell the whole group that if you're developing any project, whether it's an agency or a private enterprise, the two most important things that you can do for yourself are credibility. Make sure you have great credibility. And two, if you tell people who have an honest question that you'll get back to them, get back to them. And that was Denise Antonelli. And I thought that piece of advice that she gave the room was really good advice. I didn't like some of the other moderators and facilitators who suggested you just, you know, if you divide them up or you change their question, you reword their question, you can get them off their agenda and onto yours. I didn't like that because that basically was a description of open intent to manipulate.
Mm-hmm.
And by manipulating the public, you're not letting the democracy happen. If you listen to the public, listen to their concerns, and like she said, maintain credibility and come back to them and tell them why what they're concerned about isn't a concern. You know, I mean, we were open. If our concern about nitrate contamination of the water, something that makes drinking water not able to be drunk, okay, if that wasn't a valid concern, we were open to learning about it. How are you going to control the nitrate?
Mm-hmm.
And they never had an answer. They didn't get back to us with any assurance. In fact, they said they were going to lose at least 9,000 pounds of nitrates into the environment a year. Well, it wasn't going to be in any bag. It was going to be in manure.
Mm-hmm.
And the wells, once it goes into the groundwater, there's no way to get it out. And so when the gentleman talked about the dairies on Oahu that had been successful, they weren't 699 cow dairies with, you know, half as many cows often in a support herd. They were much smaller operations. And, you know, in every location has the environment of that location. Did it have springs like they do here in Mahalalepu, freshwater springs that drain the place every day, that wash it out? That's why it's the floor of a valley. Did they have streams? Were they next to the ocean? Was it a public beach area like this is? You know, each development rises and falls on its unique circumstances.
So when was the Clean Water Act passed?
Well, I know Congress provided for the public to be remunerated if they had to bring a lawsuit under the Clean Water Act in 1978.
Right.
So I mean, it's been around a long time.
So maybe that when we say there were some dairies here and they were flourishing, but maybe once we determined their impact and saw visible signs of their impacts, whether small, large, or medium, these things weren't consistent with the law that was to address
it. Consistent with the environment.
Right.
One of the head people at CTAR said something to me one day that I thought was really prudent. He said, you can move a plan, you can take a good idea anywhere, but unfortunately you can't take the right environment with you.
Right.
You have to have it fit the environment of the location, and that doesn't always happen.
So
and you're right about learning curve. Sure, there's a learning curve. What happened here on Kauai, for instance, was the Department of Health picked up the Moloa'a dairy, which was less than 400 cows. It was a Meadow Gold dairy at that point. Was draining waste across people's property and into the stream and into the ocean.
Yeah.
And the state actually sent them a letter saying that they were going to be fined $25,000 a day if they didn't get that stopped right away.
And
the state stepped in. And now the reef out there is dead. I mean, it did get an algal bloom, and it did kill the coral.
So what? When people, I'm very adamant about when they make these claims so liberally that, well, you know, it was really, we had them before, and yeah, but we then learned just how negatively they are impacting the environment and how the people's health and what have you. And so to curtail that, certain rules and certain measures were implemented and required. And so some couldn't afford it, couldn't do it, and it wasn't conducive to good environmental management. So they died on the vine, so to speak, and many other factors. But it is not, they didn't die, the dairies didn't disappear because of public opinion against them. There are many factors that influenced their demise.
We have a lot of undeveloped land in Hawaii.
Uh-huh.
And even in New Zealand, they learned after the first 20 years of their dairy industry that they can't afford to have dairies near rivers, streams, or estuaries,
uh-huh,
oceans. And they've passed a rule to that effect now. But you know what happened to them, Carol? They have 60% of their fresh water that is so degraded, it's not fit for human contact. That's part of the publication of the Independent Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment. I mean, that's a scientific finding in New Zealand. It's a nationwide loss
And they're talking about spending millions of dollars between now and 2040 is their goal to get it cleaned up. But a little island like Kauai with 68,000 or 70,000 residents doesn't have millions to spend on environmental cleanup once the toxic untreated animal waste does its damage.
Mm-hmm.
We can't afford it.
Yeah. So,
and our reefs aren't going to come back. I mean, it takes 30 to 50 years to start to grow a new reef, if it even does in an area.
But then you'd have to take also, understand the other impacts, the suntan lotion, you know, so.
Right.
But anyway, getting back to this meeting, I believe I was so fortunate to participate in it and see it. I see always some of these elements that they were talking and the strategies that they were talking about employing and the tactics. I witnessed those, and I see them being thrown up in front of me when I make requests for public records. You know, so we don't need any government to diminish our rights and access to records. We need more openness. And you know, especially when now $600 for 500 pages to see what is going on, why the pollution is allowed here. So that meeting was an eye opener, and it's, I would submit that it was the best $185 I've ever spent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
it was an education, yes.
Yeah. Is there anything else that we have? You want to hold on, or you want to?
Sure, I'm happy to hold
okay,
if you'd like.
Hold on. Caller, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Yes. Interesting, you mentioned that was our best $185 you ever spent. I guess it was for this seminar that you had mentioned. Was it a seminar or was it a...
Well, I you know, at this point, it's like I'm just trying to pick the pieces and scavenge. I don't know what you would call it, to be honest with you. It was a golden opportunity.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about golden opportunity based on what I heard earlier about someone... I guess one of the officials that was on the panel saying basically that, you know, they have to go and do, basically to go and do things to the detriment of public, not just public approval, but public knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you have to do something stupid. You know, it's interesting to me when I saw this event advertised. I saw it really as, you know.
You're muffled there a bit. Go ahead. Try to speak up a little better to the phone.
Oh, I didn't know what I was saying. But when I saw this event advertised or talked about, I just thought, I'm a little tired of this whole need for quote-unquote democracy in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't really take a lot of these seminars or... How do I put it? The conclave, seriously? Or how can we be more, how can people in Hawaii be more engaged? How can they do this, that, or the other? Well, you have to keep in mind, most people in Hawaii are not upper class to upper middle class people. They're working class to poor people. They've got to work, or they've got to survive, and the focus is on survival. The focus is not on coming out to a meeting and making a public presentation or a public comment. That's not the priority. You know, public comment and those aspects are very important, or fairly important. But you have to understand, people have to understand that's not a priority for them.
And let me ask you this. If the public, the uneducated public, should be involved and get... we don't see their participation because they're, quote, uneducated, then isn't it on the, falls on the shoulders of the educated to do what's right? It's for those that are holding these conferences and sponsoring them and convening them to do what's right, because it's about ethics and it's about environmental management and sound management and concern for the earth, the planet, the environment, the people. So is it, maybe we should look at it as that the educated idiots are the ones who are seeing the dollar signs, and so therefore the people that don't participate, well, they don't participate, but maybe they see trickery when they see it. They know it when they see it. So I'm always worried about when the public is, it comes to the point, well, they don't participate. They may not participate because they just know they're stacked deck.
Right. Here's the point that you made. You stated the uneducated public. That's essentially how a number of these officials and others basically see the public, whether they'll see this or not. They'll probably never see it unless they're recorded to this station. But that's how they look at the public. Doesn't matter whether it's Hawaii or some other station. Mm-hmm. That's how they see it.
Yeah.
So when you have a conference like the one you just described, and you have somebody basically making a statement like you did, I could see why you mentioned that that was $185 well spent. You're getting at least a nugget of truth there.
I couldn't buy a bundle of books, my friend. I couldn't buy 50 books that would afford me the education that I witnessed there on how to hoodwink the public, how to take away from the public, how to... You learn in basic environmental management, resource management classes, is that you see how they do it by taking it in increments, tidbits. This is one swell swoop. We're going to bring them in. They're going to be so enamored with all the flyers and brochures and all, and we're going to hand it to them this way, and we're going to bring in this nonprofit organization and put them in the midst of this person, and we're going to bring in stakeholders that really aren't stakeholders, but we diluted, and in that effort will pay off. And then, so therefore, the nonprofit that is involved will get this information. And then, because they are a nonprofit and a private entity, they don't have to disclose the information, nor are their meetings public. They can choose who participates in the meetings. But yet, we go to the beginning, it was a public interest matter. That's where the sneakery and the snakery comes in. You follow?
I like that term. But, as somebody who was a journalist, when you mentioned what that official said, or someone had mentioned, or maybe you guessed that, that's the kind of thing that you look for. That's the kind of thing that you would, that you kind of give a few bucks at.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would, oh, man, I can't believe they said that quote. Now I got it.
That's why you should listen to the Carol Cox Show. Where else do you have a tape of someone with the gonads to play a tape with someone politically connected that says, anytime I decide to, I'll just take it out of the public arena, the public forum, and go behind closed doors? That's why you need to tune in more often, my friend. No, just kidding.
Well, maybe
that is
get information like this.
Yeah.
That is sort of the confirmation of what people, I mean, that's what I could think, but you can't prove unless you see somebody actually say it. And then I could tell people, this is the way they operate, this is the way they set up.
Yeah.
But that's the way it's supposed to be, and this is the way things are supposed to run, and that's the system. I say, yeah, but the system is flawed, and this is because people are leaning this way. And so when someone actually states something that confirms the truth about what I could tell people.
And knowing that while cameras are rolling and cell phones are rolling and social media and all of that, and he was willing to state that, I'm hoping to put it together in a package and ask the mayor, hey, all those decisions, what was on the table and what was off the table? What was behind closed doors and what was not behind closed doors? And then this mayor, hey, and this mayor is advisor to our illustrious governor now. So isn't that, I'm hoping that it spills over and we ask the governor, hey, these guys have already contrived a method of keeping the public in the dark. So are you going to employ their tactics now? Is that why they're on board? You're supporting your team?
The whole thing about secret meetings and secret deals is something that I think really needs to be looked at. I mean, you had the whole secret Airbnb meeting with the governor with Airbnb that's something that you, that I think people need to be very wary of.
Yeah.
Anytime you have people here, there's no way that elected officials should be conducting all these people because there's no public, not only no public access, but no public knowledge until you get something in a,
yeah,
a forum, a news site, or a news, newspaper, or what have you.
Yeah. Well, let me go to this other caller, go back, and thanks for calling, and we'll talk, and we'll play with that, the video, that the audio, and if you want a copy of it, I'd be more than happy to share it with you for your writings, and because I think it's an awesome feeling to sit there and go, he didn't say that, no way would he, but then remember, he's amongst the educated.
That's what I mean, when they say it, that's the deal.
So, dummies like us, we wouldn't understand it anyway, so, you know. Okay, well, we'll talk to you later. Yeah, Bridget, go ahead. You have any more comments? We got about 8 minutes.
Carol, I'm glad that you do what you do, and I wish more people could have been there to hear the moderators. The facilitators that came were all bright, engaging people. And they were offering their services to help government agencies hold public meetings and keep the public under control. And that's absolutely what came out of that symposium. And it was called a symposium, meaning an educational session, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where we all contribute knowledge and supposedly the whole body that attends goes away more educated than they were when they came.
Remember when you had chickens when you were younger? You guys, did you raise chickens?
We raise chickens and rabbits.
Yeah, you go out there and you hit the tin with the thing and the chickens come running.
Right.
That's what they want from us. They want us to flock to their gathering and take us to slaughter and then give us a little chicken scratch. And then the next morning you wake up, how did Kiwalo Basin get in the hands of a private entity? Oh, they must have had mediators and facilitators and, you know, unbaked potatoes or something.
Well, and something that last caller said, too, that's true and very concerning is that the public, in part, sort of expects this deal-making behind closed doors. And
mm-hmm.
like you said, they suspect it, but they rarely get real proof of it. But it discourages the public process. And so what Mr. Soon admitted to is really sad because good people whose time is private and whose time is precious don't want to necessarily give up their time and come and give their manao and share their knowledge with somebody who's doing deals behind closed doors.
Exactly, and we'll never hear that publicly, but they say the people don't participate. Well, maybe they see something that we don't see, right?
Well, maybe they're Akamai, you know?
Yeah. Well, okay. Real quick, this yesterday or Friday was a Keok, and I didn't want to talk about that, but if you could, next week I'm going to actually try and talk about that, and we have some recordings from that, the Borderland and Natural Resources. If you could, can you do it in a minute and tell us what that was about real quick?
Sure. The public is just becoming aware that there's a lot of large private landowners on Kauai that have old sugarcane diversions. And there's been a couple Supreme Court decisions where the state waters, well, all of our fresh water is waters of the state by case law, Supreme Court case law,
mm-hmm.
by Constitution, and by Hawaii revised statutes. And it specifies that the use of water can only happen if it's intended for, like, giving fresh water to the public, serving agriculture. But no one large landowner is supposed to just be consuming
mm-hmm.
water on their property or hoarding it. And we found several diverters over on Kauai that are indeed doing that, and they're filling big reservoirs on their property with state water. And then they're selling it back to the county, and then the county in turn sells it to co-op members of our electric company. And our electric company has two diversions that are a particular concern because
they go to hydro plants that only produce 1% of the island's electricity. So it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the electric company that's been turning down contracts where people want to get solar panels on their roofs, and they say, no, we can't take any more power sharing agreements right now with the public. And yet they're keeping these old hydro plants alive, and we're trying to think why. We're scratching our heads.
So
and then comes out in a county council meeting that DHHL beneficiaries, there's 1,000 on Kauai who have rights to Hawaiian homelands that they can't build or live on because they're told there's not enough water.
Mm-hmm.
And in effect, that's just not true.
So the hearing on the Bula land, because
so
we're down
it was all about
county.
Water.
And they granted KIA authority.
KIUC, our public utility, they granted them another year of a month-to-month revocable permit, but just barely, by a vote of 4-3.
And Suzanne Case did not recuse herself because her cousin, Steve Case, is the owner of Grove Farm, and Grove Farm, some of the water they're involved in, is that correct?
Yes, but, you know, it's interesting, and I don't know how they do this.
We don't have a lot of time now, so just
okay,
go ahead.
There's 4 diversions that are Grove Farm diversions that also go to these hydro plants, but they're not recognized on the permit.
Mm-hmm.
The only 2 diversions that are recognized on the permit are the diversions that are on state land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, that's a point that's going to be developed downstream.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that next week if you want to join in. I'm going to be playing some of the recordings and what have you.
Okay.
So.
It was enlightening.
Yeah.
It was a lightning hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bridget Hammerquist from Friends of Mahalapu. I'm a friendsofmahalapu.org. Go ahead and give the spelling right quick, and we'll get off here.
Yes, and just so we don't mistake, the effort with Board of Land and Natural Resources was a coalition of citizens, Sierra Club.
Yeah, no problem.
Papa, and Friends of Mahalapu.
That, that's
and Friends
okay.
of Mahalapu is MAHAULEPU. MAHAULEPU.org. Friends of Mahalapu.
We'll get that straight.
Next. Like to visit.
We'll give credit to everybody next week. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Bridget.
Thanks, Carol.
Aloha.
Thanks for what you do.
Thank you so much.
And you've got a great site. People can listen, just listen live, or they can listen to your podcast, and that's kind of neat. Our members do that a lot.
All righty. Well, thank you, and tell them I said aloha and hello.
All right.
All righty.
Carol Cox.
All right. So, guys, this entire thing, it's all related. I tried to connect the dots here. So next week as well, we'll take some time to talk about the Kauai waters, but I'm following a more interesting thing here. Senator Donovan De La Cruz. Now, I don't want to cast aspersions on him or impugn his integrity, but there's a situation that at the over there at Alawai Canal, and there's a development there. Senator Donovan De La Cruz is a officer in the company called DTL. DTL got a contract to prepare and manage a master plan, including public outreach and infrastructure announcement planning for the Alawai Small Boat Harbor. Now, is it okay for Senator Donovan De La Cruz to be part of an owner of a company or be an officer in a company that gets a contract from the Department of Land and Natural Resources to do a master plan for the Alawai Boat Harbor? I don't know, but I'm going to ask those questions. I send him questions. He is the head of Ways and Means in the Senate. And the contract calls for $300,000 is the estimated value of the contract, the work that needed to be done. De La Cruz's company bidded $99,000. So there's a big question there. If the agency thinks that it's worth, it costs us $300,000, obviously they didn't just pick that out of the air and that the work would have cost that much, or close to it, better than guessing at $99,000, because if it was just a pulling it out of the air, they would have said $99,000. So my concern is that in this effort to find out if there were change orders, did bidding $99,000 on a $300,000 contract assures you of getting the contract.
but then it leaves you with the ability to do change orders later. So that's the big question. We'll be following that and asking those questions. And Suzanne Case authorized it. Edward Underwood actually signed it okay on the committee. And we'll talk about that extensively. But that's a big question. Should a senator have ownership in a business that provides services to a state agency and then file on the bid the project and then get it and is there change orders? Caller, real quick. I know you got something burning. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, Carol, you're talking about...
So, anyway, guys, we'll be back next week, and I hope this was informative, and let's keep chasing them now, because when you go in the public forum and tell the public that, yeah, I occasionally take it, and when I think it's necessary to take it off the table and go behind closed doors, I do that. When do you introduce it back to the public? And who participates in the deliberation? The public does not, because that's why you excluded them. So we'll be back, and some say not too soon, but we'll be back and talk about Mr. Ray Soon and Kirk Caldwell. Aloha. Take care.
This has been the Carol Cox Show, heard every Sundays at 9 a.m. on K108. Tune in again next week, Sunday at 9 a.m. to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 a.m. KWAI Honolulu.